It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, John Ross. John Ross is author of the new book, Zapatistas, Making Another World Possible, Chronicles of Resistance, 2000 to 2006. And as a perfect intro, actually, I'm going to borrow from the first page in his book, a review by John Leonard, introducing John Ross, John Leonard, who writes for Harper's. John Ross, 66-year-old Huck Finn, Holden Caulfield, Dennis the Menace, weatherman wannabe, and subversive journalist, who is no happier than he was in any decade of the old one, but he is in no more danger of selling out than he is of finding a buyer. Murdered by Capitalism, which was his last book, reports what happened to both America's North and South after Hugh Thomas and John Demos started looking, after Joan Didion left El Salvador, after NAFTA opened like an operetta to an audience of Globo cops. And Ross, a vestigial wobbly who's been on the losing side of every cause since the Spanish Civil War, is as close to we've got to a lapu-lapu. John Ross, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
The American lapu-lapu, here I am. And Google it up.
Lapu-lapu.
Lapu-lapu.
And, of course, you have a couple more years on you since he wrote that. He wrote that for your last book.
So. Right. Yes. We're in our 70th year, or we're on the lip of our 70th year here.
So you are just recently back from Mexico. There was obviously a recent election there. We're just seeing in the last couple days fist fights in their Congress. Tell us about what's going on there.
Well, yesterday was the inauguration of the person that was declared president of Mexico, Felipe Calderón, from the right-wing party, the National Action Party, that has actually controlled the Mexican White House for the last 6 years. We had an election last July that was probably the most egregious electoral fraud that I have ever imagined in Latin America, and I've been covering electoral fraud for 21 years now out of Mexico City and somewhat of that before. This is my fifth Mexican presidential election. Prior to what happened this year, the benchmark for fraud in Mexico was the 1988 election, which was stolen from Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas after the system crashed. That was the government's explanation. For 10 days on election night, when it came back up, Cárdenas had disappeared, and the pre-candidate, the man that negotiated NAFTA, Carlos Salinas, was selected by a little less than 1% of 50% of vote. Elections in Mexico, because of that great fraud, have gotten a lot cleaner over these years, but this year everything was up for stake. And we saw the use of the federal electoral authorities, the Federal Electoral Institute, the IFE, distorted and biased in favor of the right-wing candidate from the very beginning of the campaign. Elections are stolen in Mexico before, during, and after the election. So that whole run-up to the election was really a period of increasing bias, allowing transnational corporations to buy time on television to display these horrendous hit pieces, and a negative campaign has come to Mexico thanks to a U.S. citizen, Fox commentator, a guy named Dick Morris, who's been campaigning all over Latin America for the right-wing candidates. He was active in the Bolivian election against Evo Morales, active recently in the Nicaraguan election against Daniel Ortega, and very active in the Mexican election with these negative hit pieces that became kind of the centerpiece of the Calderón campaign, in which López Obrador was labeled right on the screen a danger, un peligro to Mexico. For 6 months, sometimes those commercials appeared four times in one single commercial break on the 10 o'clock news. It's kind of a way of trying to mesmerize Mexicans. And it was always a shot of López Obrador, the left-wing candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, former mayor of Mexico City, then a shot of Hugo Chavez or Subcomandante Marcos or some boogeyman, and then maybe Mexico City falling down, and then the word peligro, or danger, stamped on the screen. The federal electoral authorities refused to halt those until the court finally said this is libelous, you can't do that. And that was like 2 weeks before the election. But there are many other examples of this bias that took place in that whole period. Election day, we saw some of the most blatant vote stealing that I've ever witnessed. And, you know, these were techniques we thought had gone away. But it's very arcane. The party that was in power for 7 decades, the Pri, kind of developed this whole panoply of dirty tricks. One is called, say, the taco, where you take your ballot and fold it around 5 pre-marked ballots and drop them slowly into the ballot box, you know, stuffing the ballot box in that way. But and that was actually, we have a lot of videotapes of what happened during that. And then the count after the election was completely distorted again. We had a preliminary count in which 3 million ballots that were cast were removed because of inconsistencies the way it was defined. Most of those were for López Obrador. When finally López Obrador was successful in getting the tribunal that had to legitimize the election, and the right-wing candidate Calderón won by 0.58 of 42 million votes cast, about 233,000 votes. When finally that tribunal allowed a little less than 10% of the votes to be cast, López Obrador picked up millions of votes. There were more votes annulled than Calderón's margin of victory. And if you extrapolated it out, López Obrador actually won the election by a little more than a million votes, if that sampling can be extrapolated out, less than 9.7 of the 130,000 polling places. This was an election the U.S. could not lose. The transnational corporations could not lose. This was an election in which Mexico's geopolitical standing was up for grabs. Is Mexico a servile client state of the United States, part of North America? Or, in fact, is its real alliances with the new Latin left? We have a new Latin left today in Ecuador, actually. Raul Correa having won the election last Sunday, despite attempts to steal it from him in the first round. And, you know, but this was the big prize. U.S. and Mexico have a 3,000-kilometer border, obviously. We saw these articles in the New York Times. In the week before the election, New York Times Magazine section, as a matter of fact, written by Susan Sontag's son, populist at the border. Populist has become kind of a new word for terrorist. You know, if we look at what Cheney says about Chavez, he equates those terms, populist and terrorist. You know? And the U.S., intervention in this election was very pronounced. From the embassy, George Bush calls Calderón less than 24 hours after the IFE has declared him the victor in the preliminary count. He calls him from Air Force One, as a matter of fact, you know, to congratulate him on his victory when there was no victory at all. And most of the stuff was timed so that the national and international press would pick it up at 5 o'clock Monday. Everybody writing your articles and going to bed. And so on Tuesday morning, we wake up and after the election, we wake up and see the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, Washington Post, and the Boston Globe saying, hey, you know, Calderón won this election. Congratulations. So anyway, this was indeed the most egregious fraud that I have seen in many a year in Latin America, and what has resulted since then is really a byproduct of, or the end result of, just the bitter fruit of what happened in the stealing of this election. López Obrador called his people into the street. 3 days after the election, he had 500,000 people. 2 weeks after the election, he had 1 million people. And 3 weeks after the election, 30 days after the election, he had 2.4 million people in the streets, the largest political demonstration in the history of Mexico. They stayed in the streets, blocked the city for 7 weeks, acclaimed him as a legitimate president. He was inducted November 20th. In this period, since November 20th, which incidentally is the anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, and December 1st has been one of great fermentation and street action resistance in Mexico City. The Congress had been sealed off by the military. 3-foot-high barriers, 5,000 troops, tanks, water cannons, snipers up on the roofs to keep the people away from the legislature. Deputies that support López Obrador from the three parties that were in his coalition took the tribune, the presidium of Congress, 3 days before Calderón was to be inaugurated. The right-wing party, the PAN, also took the tribune and they camped there. They were divided. They fought for 3 days. Calderón walked into a war zone. This had been going on, actually, for 3 days. And so yesterday's brawling was just another chapter in this. The presidential guard, military presidential guard, brought him in through the back of the from the back of the stage, moved him through the part of the stage that was being held by his party people. He went to the microphone. He had to put his own sash on. He made I think it's a minute and 30 seconds he spoke, and then they hustled him back out, and he was then inaugurated. He was then the president of Mexico because he had this constitutional commitment to go to Congress to do this. It's a mandate. He had actually been sworn in the previous night by the outgoing president Vicente Fox in the presidential palace before a military guard. There's a voice off camera swearing him in. We don't even know who that was. That's the first time that's ever happened in the history of Mexico in any kind of election, where the candidate has been actually sworn in off camera or on camera, but in a private situation. No, and I think that scene of him being sworn in on television tells us how Calderon is going to try and rule for the next 6 years if he makes it. Will essentially be with the military, because he was surrounded by the military at that swearing in, and with the media. And so I think that's really his action plan for the next 6 years. The country is ungovernable at this moment. We've had all sorts of upheaval for months and months, specifically in Oaxaca. So the situation in Oaxaca continues to be very violent. Death squads are roaming the city. 20 people have been shot down by the death squads in the employ of the governor, Ulises Ruiz. We know about Brad Will, indie media reporter, 36 years old, slain on the barricades in Santa Lucia, just outside of Oaxaca, but we don't know much about the other 19 people that have been killed by these death squads. They're professors, teachers who have been on strike for many months, and members of the Oaxaca Popular Assembly, or the APU. And that situation is a flashpoint. We have the Zapatista Other campaign traveling around the country, organizing points of resistance in communities that usually don't make the map, that aren't really on the grid, you know, and putting together this tapestry of local resistance down below. Mexico is very volatile. It's a tinderbox at this moment, and we don't get that news.
So the situation you're seeing now in Mexico, this has been heading in this direction for a long time.
It certainly has been heading in this direction a long time. Things in Mexico are, you know, we have a country in which 73 million out of 103 million people are living in and around the poverty line. NAFTA has exacerbated the way people are living. It's driven 6 million farmers and their families off the land as a result of this inundation of bad corn coming in from the U.S., all of it transgenic corn, destroying Mexican corn. We have this saying in Mexico, you know, no hay país sin maíz, there's no country without corn. And, you know, it's the heart and soul of Mexico, and it's being destroyed by NAFTA and forcing farmers off the land. And they're heading north. They're into the migration stream. That's why we've had 2.4 million people attempt and have crossed the border without papers during the regime of Vicente Fox since 2000. Since NAFTA was signed in 1992 by the first Bush and Carlos Salinas, 5,000 Mexicans and Central Americans have died coming across that border to take a job that no North American will take. You know, it's more than the World Trade Towers. That's more than the number of troops lost in Iraq, although the Iraqis have lost 650,000 people. No. So, you know, the effects have been nefarious. People are poor, and neoliberalism in the form of NAFTA has really been the cause of this, as it has been all throughout Latin America. And all throughout Latin America, people have risen up against neoliberalism and the lack of protection, the privatization of their natural resources, of their phone companies, their health system, their transportation systems. And they've elected left-center presidents, social democrats from Tierra del Fuego, on up to the Mexican border. And indeed, they elected a social democrat, left-leaning candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, last July, and they stole the election away from him.
So you've been following the Zapatista movement since its inception. In fact, I understand you were the first U.S. reporter to interview Subcomandante Marcos.
I don't think so. I was the first guy to write a story on the Zapatistas before the rebellion in 1993. I think La Jornada, my colleague Blanche Petrich, beat me to the first Marcos interview. But we were there. We broke the story in an eccentric Northern California newspaper, the Anderson Valley Advertiser, 7 weeks before the rebellion began. So we've been on it for a long time.
So where do you see that movement heading now?
The Zapatista movement is, you know, sui generis. It's its own thing. It's a very unorthodox rebellion, and after now we're in our 13th year, we'll celebrate that January 1st. Is real distinct, but I think it's a new way of doing things. And basically, it deals with autonomy, communalism, getting off the government grid, constructing your own infrastructure, taking charge of your own life, taking charge of your own school curriculum, taking charge of your own healthcare system, finding a way to finance that. They're doing it through organic coffee, buy Zapatista coffee, and, you know, building another world. And that really is the title of the story, you know, and it is a story. I'm a storyteller, and this book is a story. The subtitle, Making Another World Possible, borrows that phrase that we use all the time, began at Seattle right here in 1999, you know, at the demonstrations, Another World is Possible. And what we've seen the Zapatista continuum these last 6 years has been essentially to build that other world, making that other world with their backs and their wheelbarrows and their calloused hands and their good hearts, putting together this other world, which is possible.
So you see them as an example for what is starting to, well, what has been happening in this country for a long time, but seems to be picking up some its pace.
Yeah, I'm really impressed by what I've seen. I've been on tour since the beginning of October, from border to border and a bit beyond, because I've been in British Columbia, as a matter of fact, just recently. And, you know, I speak to audiences of people that are interested in the Zapatista phenomena and Mexico and general people south of the border, and mainly to audiences of Mexicans in the U.S., Chicano activists here, and to leftists, and specifically a lot to anarchists. And I really see this coming together of those three forces, Mexican and Chicano activists and anarchists from one place to another, in one struggle after another. South Central Farms in Los Angeles, for example, last spring's immigration marches, whatever is local. And it's become kind of the prevailing thinking within this movement that was once a solidarity movement that provided old clothes for the Zapatistas, is now basically one that says, be a Zapatista where you are. Work on local issues. Don't be attached or imprisoned by these old left ideologies, you know. Find new ways of building coalitions. Get off the government grid. Take charge of your own life, you know. Stand up with your brothers and sisters all over the world in Latin America in solidarity, because that's where our allegiance are too. And it's very optimistic in a world that seems darker and darker all the time. It's a very optimistic stroke to see this coalition developing, this space. And it really does, it works on a lot of different issues, but it really does come together through the whole Zapatista concept of taking charge of your own life.
And do you see this resurgence primarily coming from young people, or is it people across the board?
No, it is primarily young people. I'm 70 years old, and I'm a veteran in here. I'm kind of I always call myself the Willie Loman of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, because I'm always lugging those suitcases full of books around. But, you know, kind of a grandpa in this situation, I guess. But it's really interesting to see some of the things that are happening, and I've run into along the line here on the run, is that three different formations. One is the New Black Panther Party, chaired by the chairman is Fred Hampton Jr., whose father was slaughtered by the Chicago police way back when in 1969. Another is the New Brown Berets, specifically in Watsonville, California, a Mexican city with a long history of resistance and rebellion. But the Brown Berets have become a phenomenon throughout California. And I was just at Lewis and Clark in Portland for the Northwest meeting of Students for a Democratic Society, or revival of SDS. Now, you might say these names are a little bit retro. But young people, I think, are reaching back to try and, try and utilize and revive those structures and put them back together again. And there's certainly plenty to work on in this country right now.
And it seems especially courageous to be reviving those particular groups, given the current climate here in the U.S. with the Department of Homeland Security and the current paintbrush of environmental groups that do direct actions, painting them as terrorists.
Well, the whole Green Scare thing, which was a major part of the SDS conference, it took place in Portland. Portland's been a center of this. I think that's only natural. But I don't know if we have many options. You know, one of the things about this country is that it provides this gamut of options that can divert us from what the goal is and from what we're trying to achieve, which is a just society. And most of them are personal options. You know, the ability to choose to go to a first run of a new movie rather than go to a vigil out here in Westlake, say at Westlake Shopping Center every Thursday night where women in black meet. No. So, you know, we need to make those personal sacrifices and narrow down the superfluous options in this society. But really, the international situation and the national situation is such that we really don't have much option but to resist this stuff that's coming down. And, I realize I'm speaking on a station that espouses the Air America way of doing things, but the truth is that there isn't much difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. It's one party with two heads. And so everyone that was elated by the victory in November ought to really take a second look at where we are, you know, a couple of weeks or 3 weeks after that. You know, first day after the election, Nancy Pelosi took impeachment off the table, as did John Conyers. And that's the left of the party, John Conyers. And in that sense, I think that, you know, we have to make that a collective decision. And we have to be in the street. San Francisco, I was happy to see a number of hundreds of people in the street outside Pelosi's office the day after the election. We can vote. I'm not against voting. I think that it's a poor measure of democracy. Voting is, you know, is elections are bought and sold, whether it's here or there. What we're seeing in the Florida district, Kathleen Harris's old district, is really an indication that the electoral fraud crosses border, whether there's a triple barrier fence there or not, you know. And so we're seeing this again, 18,000 votes lost, you know, in the state where Kathleen Harris committed these egregious acts of fraud. So, but that's voting, you know. Then we need to be able to present our force in the street, present our actions, our plans, and impress upon our representatives in legislatures that they have an obligation to the people. And that's what's missing in this equation here, that we need to have that public pressure from the street all the time. And we're in the belly of the beast, so it's harder to do that. And again, so many options. But, you know, I think that social action is good for folks, good for your soul. You know, it gets you out there in the street. You get a lot of exercise that way, you know. Us old people can get out there and, you know, kind of walk around like we, you know, like we need to do. You know, it gets our blood running. I have to read the New York Times every morning to get my blood running, you know. It's like, you know, because the lies that fill those pages, you know, really get me up. So. I advise it, I counsel it, and I urge everybody to be in the street whenever you can.
Yeah, it seems like one of the things we could be importing from Latin America is that spirit of taking to the streets.
Well, yes, sure. And that's, you know, what I've done for years and years and years in Mexico reporting is really to try and bring that concept, that ethos of public participation in politics, you know, to folks here on the other side of the triple barrier now. And really, by example, to incite some rebellion here. Now, sometimes I've been successful on certain issues, and on other issues, people have just gone on and disregarded some egregious injustice that might have occurred. But the truth is that it's been my responsibility. I've been a freelance journalist for almost 50 years, and most of the time spent in Latin America. And, you know, it's a marginal life, no? I always tell J-school students, and I've got, you know, doing some J-school stuff now, is that they forget it. They don't have a career in journalism. Journalism is not a career builder, no. What they have is an obligation to report the truth, an obligation to their sources, an obligation to get the story out. In Mexico, we call that position oficio. It's kind of the position that you have within a village or within a town, the oficio of responsibility. So I think that's, you know, I think that's, we need to have more reporters like myself that feel that they have a responsibility to the story and to getting that information out in whatever way. We're blocked a lot in terms of getting it out in the print media, and now less print, more electronic, and more cybernetics. No, but we're often have a difficult time to get that stuff into the corporate press. The corporate press doesn't want to hear it. Corporate press has an obligation to corporations. No, and so we have to find and devise other ways of getting that truth out. Sometimes I do it in poetry. I will, in fact, be presenting some of this information in poetry with my latest chapbook, Bomba. Here it is with a big bomb on the cover. Are we on public access? There we go. Bomba. And these are poems that I bring back from the Middle East, mainly, but also from Latin America. I've been working a lot in Middle East on Middle East stuff, basically Iraq. We went to Iraq as human shields back in 2003. And in Palestine, picking olives. And in Turkey, just recently, working with draft resistors to a very militarized system. And in other places, in other hotspots in the Middle East. So, the way I work is that the outtakes of my stories are often poems, where I notice things that don't kind of fit into the story, but seem to have a certain poetry to them. And all of these stories have music to them, and I listen to that music, and I write poems from that music. So I will be presenting both at Elliott Bay tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Both the new book, Zapatistas, and the new chapbook of Poetry Bomba, with a little taste of Jim Page tomorrow. And then on Tuesday night, Jim and I are going to let our hair down, what hair we have left. Jim has a lot more than I do. And we're going to, you know, stretch out and do some political singing and some political poetry and some political reading. That's at the Wayward Cafe out in the Greenwood District, 8570 Greenwood Avenue at 8 o'clock on Tuesday night tomorrow. It's 2 in the afternoon, social justice series at Elliott Bay Book Company.
And you had mentioned personal choices, and also I know from our conversation here that, you know, you're not getting rich from any of this. You've published numerous books, but the money doesn't seem to like find its way back to you from that. So one of the ways that people can support you is to turn out to these events and purchase your books there at the events.
That's one way to do it. And you know, money is just something we use to eat, to tell you the truth. And I've been stuck down here in the Days Inn here for a country. I'm sorry, I've plugged something here for a bunch of days. So that does, you know, kind of offset the kind of traveling around cost that I have. And but we don't get rich, you know. And until I got old, I didn't have any kind of health care, you know. And so in a real sense, this is a dangerous business. Brad Will being shot down on barricades in Oaxaca just a month ago really brings it home. We have a lot of independent journalists that are suffering the same fate. I want to plug here a young man named Josh Wolf, who will break the record as to the number of the amount of time he has spent in federal prison for refusing to turn over his sources video of a anti-globalization demonstration took place in the Mission District in San Francisco last summer. He's already been in jail for 100 days. The courts have refused to entertain any new appeals, and he will be in jail through July. That will break any existing record of any reporter that's been imprisoned and certainly bypassed by a long shot the notorious Judith Miller, who did about 85 days, I think, in jail, for the crime of reporting 11 mendacious front page stories about how Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, but for refusing to turn over the name of some unknown neocon who had told her that Joe Wilson's wife was a CIA agent. No, so, you know, Josh Wolf lived like him. He's been in jail for a long time and will be through July. Josh Wolf, Rod Will, they're examples of a younger generation that are doing this independent reporting, who feel this obligation, this responsibility to get the story out. And I think we owe a great debt to them.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
We've just been talking with John Ross. He is author of the new book, Zapatistas, Making Another World Possible, Chronicles of Resistance 2000 to 2006. And again, he's going to be speaking tomorrow at 2 o'clock at Elliott Bay Books, and then Tuesday, 8 p.m. at the Wayward Cafe.